We kick off.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Stephen Hadley.
And it's a great pleasure to be speaking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First
My slightly
question,
croaky voice.
A bit of a standard one, is to share with us, if you would, Stephen, what is currently dynamizing, retarding, exciting, interesting, preoccupying you?
I am midway through writing a monograph on cultural democracy, which I opened this morning to find an error fault in the file, which has alarmed me enormously. But I've written about 50-odd thousand words of it at the moment, so I'm quite deep, lost without a map and compass in that phase of writing, and also reflecting on how I think cultural democracy is probably one of the most pressing and urgent issues of our time, but also oddly feels quite unfashionable amidst the kind of the cultural industry's discourse about precarity and labour markets and da, da 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 da, all of which is very important and none of which I'm particularly interested in. So I'm feeling oddly, and this conversation as well, this strangely feels full circle, because I came of age intellectually in the 1990s, in the kind of peak era of postmodernism and cultural studies when I did my MA. And then your book, The Reader, that you did with Justin Lewis, I think I'm right in saying was the very first book I bought when I left the art sector and started my PhD. So I think I'm of that age now where I can reflect on wheels within wheels and cycles and you know, the strange way that you begin to realise that academia and the intellectual life has both phases and wheels and fashions, but also that many of the questions just kind of remain perennial for new researchers to rediscover in their own ways, which is kind of what I feel like I'm doing now.
Well, could you, much as I would love to talk about that incredibly important work that Justin and I did, I don't know why
If
we're
you,
both laughing.
I have it here. If you were
Ah,
here, I'd
oh
ask
my
you to
God,
sign
it lives.
it
It lives. So I'm wondering if you could do something rather boring, but perhaps necessary, which is to give us a sense of what cultural democracy is.
Well,
Or should be.
well, at the very present time, having just being a very small part of a review that Arts Council England commissioned on the opera and music theatre sector, it feels it has a very particular and acute resonance with the way in which cultural policy in the English context, and particularly within the context of Arts Council England's 10-year Let's Create strategy, is, if I understand it correctly, which is a big if, in the kind of post-COVID, post-levelling up, end of austerity era, if I understand it correctly, it is quite fundamentally revolutionary in attempting to re-articulate arts policy away from ideas of excellence, away from ideas of democratising high culture, to a much more bottom-up, socially and community-led way of thinking about the role of arts and culture, which I would argue is, from my perspective, the most important project an Arts Council could ever be involved in. But the brickbats that are being thrown at it left, right, and centre are fascinating. And you probably won't have seen it because it's been in just in the English media, but there have been several kind of journalistic broadsides since the publication of the report, a little over a week ago, I think. So for me, it's got very particular national policy resonances, but at the same time, I would see it very much geared in, you know, at that macro level as well, to the ambition to have culture as a, you know, one of the SDGs in UNESCO in 2030 and so on. So it's hard to answer that question because it yo-yos for me from that huge macro intergovernmental international level all the way down to very particular instances of should English National Opera be in London? Should we fund the Royal Opera House and so on? And it tracks back for me, oddly enough, to my first degree was in philosophy. So I kind of went philosophy, cultural studies, cultural policy. And that has very much determined the way that I approach and address these questions. I tend to just naturally default to big picture kind of conceptual thinking, which isn't always welcome, if you come across a more quants-based social sciences man, but there we are.
So there is something here about bottom up rather than top down, to use that cliche, right, in cultural democracy. So it's not about taking the English National Opera to the provinces, the term used in British snobbish circles to describe almost anywhere outside London. And it's more about supporting a devolved cultural milieu, is that in the sense of the arts? Is that, have I got that right?
For me, it's less about understanding arts policy through that kind of bureaucratic administrative infrastructure, even though that's where we always end up, because that's where the money is. But before that, it's about an articulation both of the state's role within arts and cultural consumption in society, but more importantly, about that, literally the role of arts and culture in society, because I think the embedded morality in the kind of old Keynesian arts council high European idea that we were somehow becoming better people through this consumption of certain forms of art and culture and so on. I mean, it seems to me self-evidently a lie or a falsehood, however one wants to portray that. And at the same time, across the world, we're seeing, to paint with a very broad brush, we're seeing quite an alarming shift to the right in the US, in the UK, in Portugal, in Denmark, in every country I go to, people are articulating this shift to me. And I would see there's forms of the way that culture can work within communities. And I guess I'm really talking about social capital here, and all of those discourses around well-being and care and empathy and social bonding. I feel that is where culture and the arts has an urgently needed role, not by having more people listening to Marla, which I don't think makes anybody more empathetic or a better person in any way. So the administrative machinations and outplays of that may involve, those old conversations about devolution and decentralization and so on as the mechanisms to achieve it. But I don't think we've fundamentally articulated the philosophical grounding of it yet.
So this is, in a sense, bringing together social science and humanities understandings of culture, where one is about living together, being together, managing life together with differences, and the other is about the aesthetic representation of processes, places, objects, and how these two become indistinguishable, in a sense, I think, that they're not finally delineable, yeah, and they intersect. So, one of the things that I've been puzzled by is, you mentioned our book from 2002. We missed the boat. That was the year that Richard Florida came out with his Creative Bollocks.
Yes.
Creative Bollocks seems to maybe have had its day and now be not quite the flavor that it was. Where does the creative industries, arts policy, culture world intersect for you conceptually? Because one of the things I've had trouble with is understanding what creative industries are, how they differ from cultural industries, how creative industries policy does or doesn't overlap with cultural policy.
It's one of the it's I agree. It's the key driver of my imposter syndrome in academia. is that I it's a you know you're in a on a panel at a conference or in a workshop or something, and somebody goes, "Oh, it's really important creative industries as a driver for X, Y, and Z." And then they immediately start talking about subsidized theatre in their hometown. And I'm like, that's not just that what? No. I mean, I've said this often in my own work, but the my reading of it is the collapse of the distinctions between those conceptual categories has been enormously useful for people's self-advancement in academia and in the arts and cultural sector and politically. But it's been hugely harmful to particularly subsidized arts sector. Let's be specific about it. The subsidized arts sector's sense of self and value, because there was a very distinct phase, which is a kind of legacy phase, I think, from, the Myerscough's economic impact studies in the 80s and so on. Well, I think it was, I mean, I always go to Clive Graves, his idea of policy attachment, of actually saying the arts needed to attach themselves to other policy areas in order to get traction in government and draw down funding and so on. And I can remember, I mean, I'm from Manchester, I and I work in Dublin, but I live in Belfast, which is where I'm sat right now. Being with a theatre company in Belfast about 10 years ago, when they got some funding from the Arts Council for an app, and them loudly trumpeting themselves as the kind of new wave of the creative industries because they had an app, and saying to them, but if you look at the DCMS definition, which, as far as I'm aware, hasn't changed, this is about exploiting intellectual property to make profit in order to contribute to GDP at its most basic level. And you're a loss-making organization subsidized by taxpayers. How do you fit into that category? So I think there's been there's been some very interesting advocacy done on the back of the collapsing of those categories. We've seen it in Ireland. I mean, there's been a hugely successful campaign in Ireland to increase subsidy for the arts. And one of those campaigns was during lockdown, which effectively said, if you don't subsidize the arts, we wouldn't have Netflix. And I would dispute dispute that reasoning. So I think it's been useful to lots of people in lots of ways. I find it really problematic because at the end of the day, as I think Justin O'Connor has written in his new book, and he's been on, I was listening to the podcast he did with you just recently. It's led to a really odd sense of the value and worth of the arts to society, deeply instrumentalized, locked down in really unhelpful categories, and lazy shorthand for that obviously is that kind of neoliberal econometrics, which is just everywhere now. So I hope the discourse is over. I don't believe it is, because too many people are too invested in its perpetuation now. But I'm, to go back to my comment about being unfashionable, I'm just doing other things.
No, for sure. And I wonder if we could go back, as they say in baseball commentary, to the period I'm assuming between when you did your undergrad degree in philosophy and when you did your master's in cultural studies, and this was, and then the doctorate. I think you said you were working in arts management of some form, is that right?
Yes, I did my master's in cultural studies in the very early 90s on Jean-François Lyotard. and his wonderful book, which I now have about 12 copies of, Postmodern Condition, which is and it's strange. It's odd. I mean, I have a very dear friend who I think you know academically. I'm Angela Piccini, who's an academic in the south of England. She's a very dear friend, and she said to me once when we were in the pub, said, you don't realize it at the time, but you have an academically formative period, which will provide the lens for everything you do going forward. In the same way that, when I was 18, 19, growing up in Manchester and going to the Hacienda and listening to the Stone Roses, it was kind of culturally formative for me. And I'd never really thought about having an academic phase that worked in the same way. But of course, I see everything through the giddy heyday of postmodernism. But I was offered a PhD and turned it down, largely due to my father, who was grumbling about getting a real job in the real world, and I kind of somehow responded to that. So went off and worked in the subsidised arts sector for many, many years, and that really has formed my thinking, both because I'm a kind of Johnny come lately to academia. I got my PhD in 2017, but because I went from being a child of a single parent, working class Manchester boy into the subsidised arts sector, ended up working at Liverpool Philharmonic Hall with the Royal Pierre in his beautiful Art Deco concert hall. And then moved to Northern Ireland to help set up and run the Audience Development Agency, which then led to the PhD in the first book. So there's been a very, I mean, I wouldn't have referred to it this way at the time, but there's been a very obvious kind of symbiosis and, iterative feeding of practice and research as I've gone through it, I guess. And I always now try whenever I teach a class on either arts management or cultural policy, I always ask the students to reflect first on their own kind of narrative journey to get to the set of beliefs that they've brought into that classroom. Because one of the key things for me in teaching arts management and cultural policy is actually unpacking the individual subjective beliefs, which everybody brings into the room as though they are objective and universal.
And going back to, in inverted commas, Madchester, and you're listening to the Happy Mondays, going, I guess, to the Hacienda Club and so on, those things are often claimed for creative industries discourse rather wonderfully. Whereas whatever else they may have been, I guess they were somewhat organic
Yes.
and commercial, but with organic ties to working people in a myriad of ways. And Dad, you were saying single working class parent. So going to university must have been a cultural shift in itself, I imagine. And then getting a real job in the, inverted commas, in the arts, also a cultural shift.
Yes, I mean, oddly enough, I was talking about this the other day because my daughter's just coming of an age where we're thinking about university. So I was the classic first person in my family ever to go to university. I went all the way from Manchester to Liverpool, which was the equivalent of going to Mars for me as an 18-year-old who'd never really left Manchester. But then, oddly enough, my journey into the subsidised arts sector was actually much more interesting because my first ever, I worked at a, I volunteered, like back in the day when you could get the dole and actually volunteer somewhere and get work experience and so on. At a small little arts centre in St Helens, which is halfway between Liverpool and Manchester.
But
And we had,
is a rugby league town rather than a football
it
town.
is a rugby league town and it's not in the least bit culturally diverse or indeed culturally open-minded particularly. But the Citadel, the Arts Centre, was fortunate in that the comedian Johnny Vegas was from St Helens and just established right at the time that I arrived there. So my first ever events that I worked, I was in a marketing role, was Peter Kay, supported by Johnny Vegas, with about 35 people in the audience. Peter Kay had just won Northwest Comedian of the Year. And then, of course, over those initial years, Peter Kay became enormously famous, Johnny became famous, and then Johnny would get his phone book out and just invite his friends to come and do gigs. So we had a huge range of brilliant, brilliant comedians working there. But again, it was a it's interesting because I didn't have the an upbringing that involved going to galleries or museums or classical music concerts or so on. I had an upbringing that involved going to gigs. And then I started working in what was, you could probably retrospectively redefine the arts centre, as a creative industries hub if you wanted to, local bands played there, there was a little studio, it was doing all of those, as you say, organic things that were actually giving people, working class people, opportunities for self-expression and so on, and self-organization. In ways that now it seems a lot of creative industries policy tries to kind of retro engineer in ways that are just deeply clumsy and quite absurd in a way. You've got me thinking because it would be really brilliant to do a study of the Happy Mondays. I mean, you've got two, Shaun Ryder and Bez, petty criminals, huge amount of drug taking, lots of crime and law break, trying to retro engineer the Happy Mondays, the government policy framework, would be both absurd and fascinating, but it would also give the lie, I think, to the way a lot of this discourse, around micro entrepreneurs and hubs and innovation and R&D and all the kind of bullshit bingo that goes with that, is actually trying to create in a lab something that could only ever develop organically in response to a unique set of circumstances.
But we all know, Stephen, that without creative industries policy, the Beatles would never have happened, nor the Rolling Stones. I mean, get real here. What are you talking about? So just for the listeners outside the UK, these stand-up comedy figures that Stephen's referring to are both stand-up comedy figures and very important also in comedy TV and social commentators. I mean,
Yes.
Johnny Vegas is a ceramicist, very true to his place of origin, and I think resides still in St. Helens. And so these are
Yes.
people for whom there is a strong proletarian connection to a culture, even when in economic class terms they may have moved outside it. And that has a long history in Northern comedy, actually, but is also very important. Now, one thing you mentioned was that you worked in an audience development agency. There are two syntams that always make my stomach churn slightly. One is human resources, which I love personnel. And the other is audience development. There's something about it that has always sent slight, very slight, probably imperceptible shivers down my spine. You're an expert in what it is and how to do it. So can you bring some relief to my tension, please, Prof.
Well, I mean, I suppose firstly, I would just go one step backwards to the etymology of culture itself, which is what I do at the start of the book that I wrote on audience development, which is this idea of cultivation. Cultivation of the individual and of the self, but also more broadly, when we think in policy terms, of the state's role in cultivating its citizens, which has always got a slightly more sinister kind of Foucauldian bent to it. But I mean, my own, I can answer your question through my own journey through that because I can remember working at Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool and feeling like I always sort of felt like a black man in Mississippi because I was suddenly surrounded by people who had all learned to play four instruments at the age of, six. And they all referred to classical composers by their first names. And, they all just had this this way of being, an ontology, just a kind of inculcated forms of social reproduction. I mean, however you want to think of it, that I simply, of course, had to adopt and blend into very quickly in order to fit in and thrive within that organization, which I did very well. And oddly found that I was quite adept at being able to adopt those social codes and understand how, I didn't refer to it at the time, but understand how the cultural capital was working. I mean, working in audience development in a large national cultural institution, when you've never heard of Pierre Bourdieu, it's a really fascinating experience because if you're curious like I was, and you had the academic, the educational background I had, you find yourself trying to understand what's happening in that organization and to yourself, but without any of the models and frameworks and language with which to do that. And so when I was running, I was CEO of the Audience Development Agency in Northern Ireland for 5 years, I think, and became increasingly disenfranchised from the idea that what we were doing was the right thing to do. And there was a very much a moral element to it, but because it was premised on this unquestioned, this objective universal sense that the arts, in inverted commas, whatever they were, was a good thing, in inverted commas. That was unquestioned. And then we moved forward from there. And I just got to the point of being disenfranchised, I guess, or disenchanted with that idea, but not being able to articulate it because, of course, a very important point, I was 100% unaware that there was any work in academia called cultural policy or, cultural studies for that matter, other than what I'd studied. It didn't feel, Liotard and Baudrillard didn't feel relevant to the art sector in Northern Ireland when I was working at it. So I just had nothing to work with, conceptually and intellectually. So you can imagine how the scales fell from my eyes when I resigned and went and did a PhD, bought your book, and many others, and suddenly realized that actually all the things I'd been thinking had already been thought, the classic early entry into academia. And that ended up in huge tussles. Dave O'Brien, who you've done a podcast with, was one of my supervisors. And I remember constantly arguing with Dave because I would say, well, everybody knows that ABC. And he would say, no, they don't. It's not in the literature. And it took me a very long time to kind of build that bridge in my mind of going, this is fascinating because everybody I know in the art sector believes this, this, and this, and knows these things to be true. But these things are not knowledge because they're not in peer-reviewed journals. So how does this work? And that was what led me on the journey to writing the book, because the book essentially was a journey back, prompted by the death, actually, of one of the very first people who had kind of tried to articulate the sense that the audience was something that we should think about. And whilst I agree with you that I don't like the paternalistic, kind of somewhat patronizing ambiance that hangs around the term audience development, it was for the people I interviewed very genuinely an attempt to shift the focus away from product, to shift it from production to consumption. And that to me has been the greatest failing of the entire Arts Council model. And if you go back to their Royal Charter, it's there right from the get-go. There should have been a much more equal balance between production and consumption. But the reality of it is they focused 98% on production and 2% on consumption ever since 1946. So, and this is a very long answer for a podcast, so I'll stop in a moment. But the other really important thing was I asked people whether they felt audience development was part and parcel of this ideological project of the democratization of culture. And almost 50% of the people I interviewed said, yes, that's what we were doing. Why wouldn't we? And the other 50%, including some very people who are now in very senior figures in the arts establishment, said, God, no, that was never what I wanted to do. And I introduced this idea of cultural democracy to them. And almost universally, they said, that's it. That's what we wanted to do. That's what we were trying to do. This was about dismantling hierarchies, not reinforcing them. So it's been an odd, as one of the interviewees said, it's like therapy. It has been a long kind of journey of processing and conceptualizing and categorizing and coming out the other side and thinking, yeah, that didn't work.
You know, one of the things that I think sometimes neoclassical economics slash neoliberals and the left have in common is suspicion of subsidies. So, for example, I'm really on board with people in the United States who point out the level to which Hollywood is subsidized by particularly state governments, but also the Pentagon, the military, because this is something that people in Hollywood that I know will never admit, even quietly, but is an everyday part of their accounting. Similarly, I find common cause with the idea that museums should think about things like visitor experience and should wonder about what is the composition to hearing a symphony orchestra or whatever it might be in terms of social structure. So there are those little bits of their critiques of lovies in British terms that I think really resonate and are powerful and matter to cultural studies traditions just as much as they do to bean counting monsters who want to control everything. And I think your answer is a very good one and a bold one, and it has definitely relaxed me. I feel calmer between the shoulder blades than I did. There are no knives in there, but nor are there little knots of tension. You, in addition to writing this monograph, you also edited a book, a reader of audience development. So maybe because you very kindly shared these with me, but I haven't had time to read them because I only got them a little while ago. But I looked at the contents pages of, for example, of the leadership, sorry, the audience development book. What are some of the greatest hits and latest memories that are worth knowing about when it comes to this topic?
The reader is really a companion to the book on audience development and cultural policy, and it was actually a way for the earlier iteration of Stephen Hadley, who was working in the arts sector, to actually just be able to pick up a book that would tell him all the things he needed to know about audience development, because that, the paywalls and the bridges and the obscure language and terminology and so on that put barriers between people working in the arts sector and the being able to really engage with academic work. So it was really that. I mean, of course, it's stupidly expensive, as most academic books are. But hopefully somebody will leak a PDF of it to some Russian website, and maybe if one person in the arts sector gets their hands on it and it makes them think differently, then I will have succeeded. Well, I mean, I guess for me, the audience development led me to cultural democracy, because it was only through that work and having to find a framework to articulate what people were telling me the genuine, true, unadulterated intentions of audience development were. I mean, in the monograph, I was on probably like page 41, I think, or 42, I actually just produced a table, two columns, one side democratization of culture, the other side cultural democracy, to try and just produce a shorthand of everything I was thinking about. And it's got the big sections on how you look at audiences from those two different ideological perspectives. Because Whilst audience development, I mean, interesting, audience development was really maligned, mostly in my experience, by artistic directors who felt it was taking money away from them. And that was my both my direct experience and also a lot of the research data. You know, it was like, I could have more money for my show if you weren't doing this ridiculous marketing thing, you know. And it's still an idea. I mean, I was in Germany last year in Munich, and these ideas are still really prevalent that if people don't come to see subsidized art, it's their loss. And why should money be spent on trying to encourage these people in? You know, the great unwashed in their smelly trainers being sat in the Royal Opera House and so on. It's astonishing, really, how prevalent and dominant those ideas remain despite decades of people like me working to counter them. I mean, one of the interviewees in the book actually said, you know, we haven't changed anything, but at least we've been on the sidelines shouting about how it needs to change, you know. And you have to take your victories where you find them, I think, you know. But it's interesting as well, I mean, that to look at the US as a counterpoint in terms of subsidy and in terms of audience development and so on, because I've written some work recently and in collaboration with colleagues in the US, Bria Heidelberg and Carol Rosenstein. And it's really interesting how the broader debate around what they refer to as ADEI, you know, that broader debate around what we would call social inclusion and social justice and diversity. In the US, it's much more about having representation at senior levels within organizations. So, you know, we need a black CEO and we need a black artistic director and so on. My experience is that that is a fool's errand. I mean, my direct personal experience, because of my own willful attempts to assimilate myself into the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra in a way that would not make me stand out at all. Yeah. So I think there are really important questions about how it's not just about that classic forms of social reproduction through generations and families. It's that social reproduction at an institutional level where the set of values that are already housed within cultural institutions are not necessarily going to be changed by variations in skin tone or political beliefs. If you have to, you know, it's like the Borg in Star Trek, isn't it? It just kind of makes everything accommodate its own underlying ideology, you know. So I think there are still really important questions that we need to ask. And I, as I said at the start, my perpetual point of entry is always at the broader philosophical, conceptual, ideological, God forgive me, level, rather than, you know, let's do a survey and get some quants on this. I think it's like, well, that's just going to reflect reality back to you, but it's not going to enable you to really engage with the underlying philosophical issues, I think. For my sins, I'll take that. This is the hill I'll die on.
It's your inner Sean Ryder expressing himself, I think.
Yes,
Sean
I could.
has managed to appear as a credible interviewee in the Grawny ad, but the Ryderisms inevitably express themselves. Prof, when we move from the audience into this question of what hegemonic subjects have said to you, that inevitably leads to another word that I stumble over conceptually, if not linguistically, and which you've also produced a what looks like a terrific edited volume for, and I have read your introduction to it, leadership, the real L word. And what I made of your introduction is that you're not exactly a fanboy of the idea.
No, it was hard. It was one of those strange, when I was writing that introductory chapter, I remember thinking, I should really get somebody to look at this just in case I've gone slightly over a red line somewhere. But then I just thought, no. But oddly, I mean, again, it's a it's a personal narrative thing, because when I was working
Right.
in the arts, I went and did an MBA because there was a particular point when I was in a senior management position. Again, it's a kind of strange imposter syndrome where, all of this discourse around arts and business to arts, and we must be more like business and da 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 da. And that kind of evangelism for KPIs and SMART objectives and SWOT matrices and so on in the cultural sector. And so I went and did an MBA, which I got a distinction in at a Russell Group University. Thank you very much. But I remember being quite appalled at a lot of the leadership literature which was being
Right.
taught
Yeah.
there, which was obviously not in any way specific to the cultural sector. And there are bits and pieces of work that Robert Hewinson and John Holden have done and so on. But it was Harvard and MIT Sloan, it was coming out of those kind of
Right.
monolithic management journals. And as I think I mentioned in the introduction to my own editing collection, written by men who'd been to war. These were guys who had been in World War II and then had got positions in academia. They were all white, they were all male, and all of those, the archetypes of cultural leadership, from Churchill to Alex Ferguson, the massive substance abuse problems. I mean, there's just there's a, as with everything, it's like, can you see the matrix, really? So I just thought, well, I mean, but partly what I did with the book was really that, again, it felt, it's partly building that bridge between the sector and academia, was that, there's plenty of books about leadership. There's a small number of books about cultural leadership. But where do you get to hear what a cultural leader thinks under interrogation from somebody who's actually asking them difficult questions? So the very first one I did was with Oliver Mears, who's director of opera at the Royal Opera House. And I'd worked with Oliver because he was based in Belfast previously. And it was a brilliant opportunity to ask him really difficult questions that he didn't like, kind of puncture the PR bubble a bit around it, because the brief for anybody who did one of those interviews to be in the book was, if you come back and you present me with a draft of the transcript that's just a PR opportunity, I'll desk reject it and you won't get published. So it was very much a kind of, ask them difficult questions. I mean, an example would be the guy, Professor Thomas Gerst, who has this stunningly fascinating job as head of global cultural policy for BMW. So I never knew that BMW had somebody, who was working on cultural policy. And this opened up this whole fascinating field that I haven't had a millisecond to even think about, of corporates defining what cultural policy is. And he's incredible. I mean, he's brilliantly intelligent, has huge amounts of money, does amazing things. But the interview transcript came back, and I was like, you don't appear to have asked him about greenwashing. Why have you not asked him about greenwashing? And sent it back. And then we added an addendum to it, going, well, we need, you need to address these issues with it. And to his credit, he responded, and we did a second piece of the interview. I mean, all of the pieces are edited, obviously. But when has anybody ever asked him about that before? So whilst I am, yes, somewhat cynical and dubious about the leadership industry, because again, it's been instrumentalized and it's been used for self-advancement and so on. I am still think there is huge learning of being able to listen to people being critically questioned in a really intelligent way about what it is that they do. And I hope we've achieved that with the book.
No, I think that the project looks great because it's not a how-to. I think in the intro somewhere you list the hundreds of millions, perhaps, of Google findings under the term leadership, right? And I know that I was a terrible leader when I was officially described as one, and I didn't want to be one. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't like what I thought I understood by it. So I failed because I didn't think it was necessary and I didn't want to do it. And I guess my experience when I too was a late entrant to academia, though not as advanced in years perhaps as you were, but when I did enter it in my early 30s, I found that it was really quite self-managing and really quite trusting. And the big thing I've noted about academia in the countries where I've worked in it is that there is a diminution in trust and an assumption that faculty are driven in the same way as managers in universities are, i.e., by self-gain, whereas they're not mostly. They want to be left alone as much as possible to do things that managers can't do, which are, guess what, teach, research, and write.
Yes.
And they used to do this very effectively. There were very few middle people, there were very few managers. Money was expended on, guess what, teaching, research, and writing. And I'm just amazed at how, on the one hand, there is this proliferation of managers who know nothing about anything, except they've read some of the hundreds of millions of Google entries on leadership. But in addition to that, whilst taking away the self-management elements, they require more and more and more administration on the part of the people who actually do the core work of universities. I'm amazed
Yes.
at this tendency, and it seems to have taken hold monumentally. I don't know about in Ireland, but in the rest of the British Isles. And it has done so devastatingly in the decade that I've been away from the United States. So I really feel sad for people who enter now and are told, you are an early career researcher. You need a mentor. Conversely, you are a leader. You are expected to do blah, 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 these key penile indicators that you mentioned earlier. There's this astonishing desire to engage in surveillance of the everyday and the lack of trust that is so keenly part of it. I wonder whether cultural studies could ever have emerged under such circumstances. Anyway, sorry for the rant. This is meant to be about you, not about me. Somehow or other, I got going.
No, I agree. But I mean, oddly enough, last week I had my expenses refused. I co-organized a conference in Santiago de Chile last year in December, and I have my and I gave the keynote or one of the keynotes at the conference, and have my expenses refused because I hadn't provided proof that I'd been at the conference. Despite, I had the seats and the flights and the hotel, but I needed to have photographic evidence of me giving a talk at the conference to prove I was at the conference, to prove that I wasn't trying to pull some kind of scam. And you're right, it's that level of distrust. But I think it's also, again, I mean, in my way, I think this is a structural issue because I think it was Henry Mintzberg who actually is one of the white American management gurus I would have a lot of time for. He wrote really brilliant work on strategy, but was deeply cynical about management schools and MBAs. MBAs particularly he wanted to see abolished, because what he saw happening was the creation of vast amounts of largely unnecessary managers who were coming out of the schools. It's like, it always reminds me of that bit, showing my age now, in the Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy, where they send off all the unnecessary workers from Earth and, lie to them and tell them they need to go and discover a new planet. And, what you've got, in a sense, I mean, the arts sector, I remember once being referred to as the home for the unemployable children of the bourgeoisie. And in a sense, now what we've seen in both health, my wife's an NHS doctor, so she sees this a lot, and in academia, is the constant shoehorning in of more unnecessary, otherwise unemployable management graduates who then have to find things to do in order to justify their existence within the system. I mean, it's a really odd thing because we were promised with the internet, weren't we, that we would see a huge disintermediation of middle management. And that happened in many ways. You know, if you think about travel, things like that, we all book our own flights and our hotels now and so on. But there's been a fascinating re-intermediation of kind of administrative and management functions in other areas of society. Maybe it's all the unemployed travel agents went and did management degrees and have come back to work in universities.
Well, I've recently done two podcasts with people in business schools. One at the University of Spoilt Children, to give it its technical title, but trading as the University of Southern California, and the Marshall School, where Paul Adler is a red hot Marxist and always has been. And yesterday I did one with some dudes from Essex University who are red hot Marxists slash anarchists in the business school. And one of the reasons why these cats get jobs is that neoclassical economists don't know about anything. They have a theory about a billiard ball table that miraculously doesn't have friction, and which is supposed to allow them to understand everything you and I want and do. So, there's never any religion. Don't worry about that. There are never any customs about makeup or hairdo, blah, 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 right? All that crap. And they actually, these places have to hire leftists who are interested in what people say and do. And when I asked these guys in these podcasts about their students, because I was assuming their students would think, this is all nonsense. Why are we being told all this labor theory of value crap? According to them, their students lap it up because the students are not there because they love capitalism, want to reproduce it. They're there because they're desperate. They're desperately worried about their futures. And they just want to invest their time and effort and energy into finding out how they can get a job and finding out what work is. And I found that very inspiring, actually. And anyway, listen, Prof, I've got a couple more questions for you, if I may, and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything that we haven't mentioned or that you'd like to touch again that we mentioned earlier. So my first question, and obviously part of this is personal experience for you and part of it's philosophy. How do you choose a topic when you're looking at the next book or the next project, whatever it might be? What are the things that animate you, that drive you, that seize you, that say, Prof. SH, this is the next baby?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think for me, I am permanently the victim of getting bored with the thing that I haven't yet finished.
Now that sounds like Sean Ryder. Sean's down again. Sean's out. Put him back in his box now.
Well, Sean Ryder is a really interesting example, actually, because he was referred to, wasn't he, as the W.B. Yeats of his era. And that said, by Tony, what's his name? Tony Wilson. Tony Wilson
Tony Wilson,
referred
late
to
Tony
Sean
Wilson.
Ryder as the W.B. Yeats of his age. And, however much his tongue may have been in his cheek, I think that sense, I've always read that as a kind of valorization of working class popular culture as a kind of kicking against the pricks, and so much of Factory Records was actually about that. That is the kind of thing I think ultimately that drives me is this sense that forms of culture have value to you in the way that they have value to you and in a way that is meaningful to you, that should not be judged by anybody else. So if your favorite cultural artifact, object, product is Folklore by Taylor Swift, then that's brilliant. And I'm totally happy for you and I think that should be celebrated, So I've increasingly developed a sense that the inextricable the triad between social justice and cultural politics and subsidy and the way that these things work within society that started off with audience development led me to think more broadly about about audience development. I mean, essentially, the book is, in a sentence, audience development should not be thought of as a management process, which, if you look at all the literature on audience development, particularly from the US, audience development is a management tool from within an organization. And the book's argument is no, we should only ever think about audience development in terms of policy because it's an ideological project that simply has management tools in order to manifest itself. And that sense, again, of the underlying ideology and philosophy of these things is what's always driven me. And I have this conversation, I still have conversations with Oliver at the Royal Opera House, who is a his couldn't be more opposed to the idea of cultural democracy if he tried. Because for me, it's about that celebration of where the individual finds meaning and representation and resonance within culture. And I refuse now to accept that there should be hierarchies artificially imposed on that. I just flatly refuse it. So for me, it's always been that journey. I mean, I want to write, I am writing, hopefully, a kind of definitive account of the intellectual history of cultural democracy. And it's taking me into all kinds of fascinating places, and oddly enough, back to Lyotard. So I'm using his model of grand narratives as a way of articulating how cultural policy works at an ideological level, and how we can break that down. And where I go next, I think, oddly, I'm finding a lot of the cultural sociology from the 1970s, which seems to never be cited or referenced anymore, deeply fascinating. So I'm condemned to be a middle-aged white man in some kind of retro cul-de-sac of thinking, but it's where I find the most fascinating work. You know, I find an awful lot of the work that's happening in the broader cultural industries field at the moment to be like I think it was Anita Roddick of The Body Shop. When she was asked about market research, she said it's like looking in the rear view mirror of a fast moving car. That's my kind of sense of it, going, I actually don't want to look in the rear view mirror of a fast moving car. I want to think about where the road's going and who built it and why. And so I have quite a different perspective on where I want to kind of position myself, I think. And it's all driven by the sense of having been brought up with a deep and abiding love of forms of culture that I then discovered were denigrated by a certain class of people. And I kind of probably just resent that at a personal level.
My last question before throwing to you is to ask you the sort of question perhaps your wife asks you, since she's a National Health Service medical professional, a doctor. How do you know all this shit?
How do I know
How do you know the things you know? Doesn't she ever ask you that?
Well, she's never read any of my books, if that's an answer. No, I mean we have a really interesting dynamic, actually. I mean, my wife's a psychiatrist. She works in child and adolescent mental health. She has an unbelievably stressful job. And deals with the most, damaged, hurt, struggling children. You know, I just don't think I couldn't do it, personally. But it's an unbelievably good corrective for working in both the arts sector and academia, where you think you have a stressful, troubling, problematic day at the office. And then you come home and hear what your wife's day has been like. So there's a really interesting dynamic there. And it's interesting when you think about, going back to the subsidy question, because the NHS has been so starved, deliberately starved of resources in order to make the case for it failing and being privatised, that I think my wife's view on art subsidy for example, is very specifically informed by the fact that they have to turn away 12-year-old children because they don't have enough beds to put them in. So it's a you get, and I'm not in any way, suggesting that we shouldn't have art subsidy because we need more money for health, because of course it's a deliberate political strategy to artificially create those that lack of resource. But it is a useful corrective to what I think you see a lot in the cultural sector and in a lot of academic work on the cultural sector, was this is implicit exceptionalism about the arts and cultural sector. As if, for example, people who are on 0 hours contracts working in the arts or precarious positions or working as freelancers are somehow more deserving of our sympathy and attention than every other person who is in those conditions but not working in the arts sector. So yeah, I mean, as for how I know it, God, I don't know. I think I've always been intellectually curious about culture in ways that I'm still only coming to understand now. Because of course, if I could wave a magic wand, the one thing I would give myself would be a really deep understanding of sociology. I used to say economics because I thought that would be helpful, but frankly, I'm never going to have a deep understanding of economics. But I think at heart, I'm a sociologist, and I've never had any training in sociology. As my wife will tell you, if I go to an art gallery, I spend most of my time looking at the people who are looking at the pictures.
So now I'd like, in order to conclude, to throw things to you to add anything you wish to.
Gosh, I'm not sure I have anything to add other than if anybody has any interesting thoughts to offer to a man who's 50,000 words into a book on the intellectual history of cultural democracy, do please get in
Touch.
touch.
Beautifully said, sir. So many, many thanks for a very enlightening and enlivening hour. And I don't think I'll ever get over hating human resources as an expression, but I think I can now listen to leadership, not listen to leaders ever, but listen to leadership and listen to audience development without, heading to accident and emergency. And that's thanks to you. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.